This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Despite what you've heard, yes, the massive Amazon fires this year are from surging deforestation there. It is the return of a world-damaging process that releases more greenhouse gases, reduces the cooling power of plants, and it threatens the lives of indigenous people and all the marvelous creatures of the rainforest. We will tour with one of the world's greatest experts on the Amazon, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. I will add notes from a webinar I attended last week with Brazilian scientists and Woods Hole. Then we travel to the other end of the earth. From the University of Alaska, Brian Bretschneider reports on crazy record-high temperatures up north, the choking smog, and the prospects of wildfires from the boreal forest right up into the tundra. From the Amazon to Alaska, forests burned this summer, changing the landscape and your climate. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Satellite shots of the treasured Brazilian Amazon reveal a massive fire and smoke this year. It is heartbreaking. No scientist knows the Amazon better than our guest, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. Thomas has won so many awards. He's appeared in Nature documentaries. He's advised three presidents. He is the father of biological diversity and helped found conservation biology. Thomas Lovejoy, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, great to be with you.
How long did you operate a research base in the Amazon rainforest?
So I first set foot in the Amazon in 1965, but then in 1979, I started a long-term research program to really understand what happens when you break a forest into fragments. So that's now 40 years and ongoing.
And when you began, did you imagine the forest destruction we are seeing now?
It was really hard to imagine. You know, by the late 70s and into the mid 80s, there began to be some major deforestation. But prior to that, most of it had been along the single highway from Brasilia, the capital, to Belém, the port city.
And Thomas, what is your synthesis of the latest news about fires in the Amazon this past summer?
Well, I think they're the consequence of slashed budgets for enforcement, as well as rhetoric encouraging people to go and deforest and try and bring some economic return, even though it's actually very trivial.
Are fire losses in the region greater this year than in years past? How serious is this?
Well, there have been years when it's been worse, but it is a big kick up from a year ago. And that basically reflects both the lack of resources for serious enforcement as well as some of the government rhetoric.
Yeah, it was kind of free-for-all of settlers, I think, in the 1990s, and then recent governments have tried to rein it in and do some protection, but that seems to be all blown away, very much like Trump is throwing away environmental regulations in the United States. Bolsonaro is doing the same thing.
Well, to be fair, a lot was accomplished, which is still there. And while there are incursions here and there, you know, literally 50% of the Brazilian Amazon, and indeed of the Amazon as a whole, is in existing conservation areas or demarcated indigenous reserves. And that's an incredible achievement when you stop to think that the Amazon is actually equivalent in area to the 48 contiguous United States.
That is amazing and a little bit hopeful. So do you think enough carbon is being released from vegetation burning in the Amazon to make global warming even worse?
Well, I mean, anytime you burn down some rainforest, you are contributing to an increase in global warming, no question about it. What really worries me and some other scientists who are familiar with it is what this may be doing to the hydrological cycle of the Amazon, which basically enables the Amazon to generate 50% of its rainfall internally. We know that at some point, too much deforestation can lead to a tipping point, and there would be dieback of the forest in the south and the east and in a bit of the center of the Amazon, just because there would no longer be sufficient rainfall.
This tipping point really interests me. Do we know how close we are to it and what would happen?
So Carlos Nobre from Brazil and I published a piece a year and a half ago in which we said that we think that nowadays, with climate change also bringing pressure and extensive use of fire bringing pressure, that the tipping point is somewhere in the vicinity of 20, maybe 25% deforestation. And Brazilian deforestation is pushing pretty close to 20%. And more worrisome, we are seeing what Carlos and I interpret as first flickers of the tipping point in historic droughts in 2005 to and 2010 and 2015-16. So they're pretty close to it. The good news, of course, is if they take it seriously, they'll do some very active reforestation and build back a margin of safety.
Do you think it just takes human action to approach that tipping point, or is it possible that global climate change could also push the Amazon towards savanna almost no matter what Brazilian people do?
Well, I mean, climate change, human-generated climate change, is part of what's pushing the system at the moment, but it's not all by itself. And among other things, the last thing you want to do is have some more forests go because of the tipping point and have all that carbon end up in the atmosphere.
But can we presume that the wave of fires this year are probably mostly set by humans rather than natural sources like lightning?
So rainforest basically does not burn naturally. If you have lightning strikes in a rainforest, you know, whatever tree gets zapped is in trouble and sayonara. But you just don't get natural fires in rainforests.
That's true. We've seen that on the west coast of British Columbia, where there are forests that just have never burned in thousands of years because it's just too wet and it doesn't happen.
That's right. So it's very similar.
Right. So Europeans just threatened to withhold a trade deal unless action is taken by Brazil's government against these Amazon fires. And journalist David Wallace Wells said something I thought was important. He says, a threat to apply the same tools of leverage and sanction and shame to crimes of climate as have been applied in the past to violations of human rights and territorial sovereignty. So I'm wondering, are we seeing some promise there of nation-to-nation action to prevent the worst abuses of the environment? Your thoughts?
So I think there are two ways this can affect the future. One is withholding some economic opportunities, such as was being talked about prior to the G7 meeting. But the other is when the international community comes together, recognizes that we can hardly expect Brazil and the other Amazon nations to take care of the Amazon all by themselves, and create a mechanism, some multilateral mechanism, as was done in the 1990s through the World Bank.
Also, Julie Turkowitz in the New York Times questions the seriousness of this year's fires in the Amazon, and the argument goes like this. It's mostly farmers and loggers burning slash in Brazil. They are not destroying virgin rainforest, but that kind of original forest is burning in Africa's Angola and Congo with no big uproar. Perhaps we should look there instead. I don't know. I'm not sure I buy that argument. What do you think?
Well, first of all, rainforest burning anywhere in the world is not a good idea. It just isn't a good idea. And it tends to go on year after year without a lot of attention to it. So it's a good thing that this popped up the way it did, because it enables people to understand that, you know, there are serious changes going on which are not good for the forest, not good for biodiversity, and not good for climate.
Science is under threat in many countries, including in the United States and Australia. Canadian climate science hasn't recovered after a 10-year attack on funding climate research. How are international scientists coping now that they're in the Amazon and they're trying to do research with the new government? Are there problems or are things still going along well?
Well, the science, the government science budget in Brazil has been essentially cut in half. So you can imagine the impacts that is having. That doesn't mean all science, you know, stops dead. Some has non-government funding or whatever, but it's just not a very smart thing to do. Because, you know, the root word for science is to know. And if we cease to pay attention to what we can learn, we're setting ourselves up for all kinds of problems.
Yes, we could have some real, well, we're already having some real surprises, and that's with the best science that we have to date. So we've got to keep up the research in the Amazon, I would say.
Well, yeah, in the Amazon, you know, and what I was saying applies to research Brazil-wide, actually.
Right. And the Brazilian government belatedly announced a 60-day ban on burning in the Amazon, and they are sending in the troops. Will that help? Is it enough? What else could the government do?
Well, of course it will help. I do worry that legitimate landholders who want to use fire to clear the leftover vegetation from last year to prepare the fields for another year of crops are going to be penalized by this. But obviously, the important thing to do here is not just try and curb the illegal deforestation, but actually create a new vision for the Amazon in which development is around its incredible biodiversity and looks for ways to understand that better and turn it into things which are useful for the world. I mean, we already have, you know, cacao, and we have rubber, and curare, and quinine, and, you know, some other medicines that come from that biology, but we've only just scratched the surface.
Yes, I kind of look at the Amazon as kind of a reserve of biodiversity. We don't know even yet all of the creatures that are there. A lot of exploring to be done, and without that well to replenish us, the planet would be much poorer or even in danger.
Well, that's completely true. So, I mean, it's really important to understand that one truly important way to think about the Amazon and that forest is as a gigantic library for the life sciences.
Yeah, I don't think the public really understands that biodiversity is in crisis and that crisis is developing right at the foundation point of life. Do you think we're in crisis? How serious is it?
Well, there's no question globally that we're in a crisis. The UN report that came out in May basically warned that we could easily lose a million species in the next 20 or 30 years unless we change some of the negative trends.
Again, the Brazilians, some Brazilians argue that the Americans developed their West. Settlers cut down the trees, planted crops, or ran cattle despite the original inhabitants. Why shouldn't Brazil be allowed to do the same with her wilderness?
Well, first of all, we haven't lost very much biological diversity in the process. We're lucky in the sense of having, you know, less diverse, simpler ecosystems. But it's also easy to oversimplify what went on in the past in North America. And, you know, there are the equivalent of demarcated indigenous areas in different parts of the United States, no question about it.
This is Radio EcoShock reporting on the state of the planet. I'm Alex Smith, honored to have as our guest the premier scientist of the Amazon and world conservation, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. Thomas, if the rest of us switched away from eating beef and using leather and purchasing soy, would that help preserve the Amazon?
So I think we need to be doing those kinds of things, not just for the Amazon, but actually for the future of life on Earth, because there are, you know, we're pushing 8 billion people now, and there are going to be at least another couple more. And we just need to change our lifestyles in ways that will create a much gentler footprint on the planet.
So, Thomas, please take a couple of minutes, if you can, to really explain the strategy that you would endorse to save what is left in the great rainforest. We'd like to learn from you.
So I think what one needs to do is, one, engage a major multilateral institution like the Inter-American Development Bank to, you know, mobilize a program that can be funded by other nations. That's step number one. Step number two, I think, is actually having a new vision for the future of the Amazon, where, for example, we recognize that rivers are the best transport systems and always have been, and highways generally just lead to destruction. We need to think about hydroelectric installations that don't block sediment flow from the Andes downstream, that don't block the migratory catfish species, which have life cycles that span from the Andes to the estuary and back. And then I see incredible opportunity if there was a serious investment in exploring that biological diversity in partnership with industry, looking for new medicines, new fungicides, other new biological products, which by definition would be biodegradable and renewable.
Right. You know, even pharmaceutical research is a multi-billion dollar industry, and that could be Brazil's industry.
Well, it certainly could. I mean, they did try it once about 15, 20 years ago, but they didn't really partner sufficiently with industry, so it never quite took off. But I think, this is something that could turn all of this into incredible financial wealth as well as, or based on the biological wealth.
And what about the argument that getting and expanding into the Amazon is, in a way, Brazil's social valve to help people who are in poverty or have no other resources as their population also expands? And that, so it would be more difficult to manage society if they actually tried to protect the Amazon more.
You know, first of all, Brazil is a really big country. It's essentially half of South America. So space is not in short supply. But the really important thing is the hydrological cycle whereby the Amazon makes half of its own rainfall. If it gets undercut and you have a tipping point, which I think is close at hand, in the south and the east of the Amazon, part of the central Amazon, you would have dieback of the forest. An immense pool of carbon would go up in the atmosphere. Huge amounts of biodiversity would be lost. And so while one can sympathize in one sense in somebody who just wants to cut some forest to clear a field, at a certain point that pushes the whole system over into a much less beneficial future.
And was there some suggestion that if the Amazon reaches that tipping point, it could also affect global systems such as the creation of rainfall in Africa?
Well, I'm not so sure about how that links to global patterns of moisture, but there's no question that the Amazon is an important flywheel in South America's climate system. And moisture from the Amazon, benefits agriculture in central Brazil, benefits reservoirs in cities of the south of Brazil, actually goes as far as Paraguay and Uruguay and northern Argentina. So you're really playing with essentially a continental climate system.
Well, this year there has been some public and political reaction to fires in the Amazon rainforest. What was your personal reaction, and are you trying to keep track of the developments sort of day to day?
Well, not surprisingly, I am on top of it as much as anybody can be on a regular basis and trying to come up with solutions and better outcomes. I think one thing that's very encouraging is how strong Brazilian public opinion was about the need to address this problem. I mean, people were literally in the streets as of Friday a week ago.
Do you feel that the biodiversity movement and concern is getting lost in the climate change debate and movement, or are they working together? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it could easily get overshadowed, but if you really stop to think about how it all works, the amount of carbon in the atmosphere from destroyed and degraded nature is roughly equal to what remains in extant nature. So that's a pretty shocking statement to be able to make. And that's the shocking part. So with so much CO2 in the atmosphere from destroyed ecosystems, if we actually got really engaged at ecosystem restoration, we could literally bring down the level of CO2 in the atmosphere to something which is much more reasonable from a climate perspective and make the future for biodiversity much more secure. And basically that means recognizing that this planet works as a linked physical and biological system, that it is in fact a living planet, and that each and every one of us can individually contribute to ecosystem restoration through planting the right kind of tree or helping restore a coastal wetland. So my hope here is this will be a great wake-up moment for society about the way the planet works and the importance of biodiversity.
We certainly need that wake-up moment. Now, a lot of your work has been to protect species from extinction. What do you make of the new Extinction Rebellion movement?
Well, I'm encouraged that there are some young people out there who really are upset about the thought of extinctions and ending what basically are 4 billion year lineages of evolution, because that's what happens every time a species goes extinct. So I hope there will be a lot more of it.
And as we wrap up here, as you head toward 80 years on this planet, what is the plan? Do you hope to work your field until the end? Do you have certain projects you hope to complete? Or is retirement really an option for you?
So retirement's not in my vocabulary. there are a lot of things that need to be done in conservation and science. I've got at least 3 more books I want to get out. So my days are full.
No doubt. And, you have been so generous sharing your time with our listeners. Thank you very much, Thomas Lovejoy.
And thank you all for caring.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We can add more perspective on the Amazon fires from Brazilian and American scientists. On September 5th, I attended an online seminar hosted by the Woods Hole Research Center. Their scientist, Dr. Michael Koh, said, quote, "Almost all of the carbon stored on land is in forests, and the Amazon is one half of the tropical rainforest on the planet. The equivalent of 10 years of global carbon emissions are stored in the Amazon," end quote. Forests also remove carbon from the atmosphere, quoting Michael Koh again. "Something like 30% of all carbon being emitted by humans on the planet is being pulled out by forests, and most of that is in the tropics, and again, the Amazon is half of that," end quote. He continues, "2/3 of all sunlight and rainfall are converted back to water vapor by tropical forests. That process cools the land surface. If you remove the forest, it heats up immediately, something like 5 degrees C or 10 degrees Fahrenheit. If you remove a chunk of land in the Amazon today, tomorrow it's 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer," end quote from Michael Koh. "And the forest, as we know, creates rainfall, which affects lands thousands of miles away, and it's a mainstay for agriculture, which means feeding people." Koh says about 7,000 square kilometers of land were deforested in Brazil this season. That is about twice the size of Rhode Island. He estimates about 140 million metric tons of CO2 will be emitted into the atmosphere from these Brazilian fires this year. The Brazilian rainforest is just not adapted to fire as some forests are on the west coast of North America. The Amazon seldom burns from natural causes. It is just too wet. So where does this new burst of fire come from? Dr. Anne Alencar is an experienced Brazilian scientist working with IPAM Amazonia. She reports as follows. They had a big peak of fires in mid-August this year, and that's very uncommon. The only other mid-August peak they have seen was in 2010 during a big drought. But this was not a year of big drought. In early July, there was a report of a spike of deforestation pointed out by the Brazilian National Institute for Space Research, or INPE. they issued deforestation alerts showing a big increase from last year. That caused a lot of commotion in Brazil and beyond. Dr. Alencar says that was really a prediction of more fires later in August, as the log piles dried enough to be burned. And that happened, and the world saw the smoke from satellite. Their team investigated comparing the areas of deforestation and the later hotspots or fires. They double-checked the number of days without rain, and that was not the cause. She says, quote, "Deforestation is increasing in the Amazon, maybe taking us to the rates we had in the 1990s and the beginning of the 2000s. This is a bit scary that we come back to that. We get the rates of deforestation that we had 20 years ago." And that ends my quote from Dr. Ann Alencar from IPAM Amazonia. So, listeners, when the New York Times and others try to say these fires are not burning the rainforest, they're just logging slash, that is technically true, but where did those piles of logs come from? The Brazilian Space Agency says they come from disappearing rainforest cut down a couple of months earlier. Michael Coe from Woods Hole discounts media discussion of Amazon as the lungs of the earth and worries about oxygen production. This is a distraction from the real issues of the amount of carbon dioxide now being released from deforestation and the burning and the changes on the ground for local climate and, of course, the biodiversity loss. The other Brazilian scientist on the panel, Paul Brando, just testified about these fires to the Brazilian Congress on September 4th. Brando says, quote, "When you look at what is happening in Brazil right now, the Amazon is connected into the global markets. What is happening in the Amazon is influenced by buyers in China and Europe and the West. Brazil and the U.S. compete for the biggest markets for soybeans, for example. So if someone stops buying grain from the U.S. or cuts back soy purchases, then we see the impact on the Amazon." Dr. Brando thinks international markets and agreements could help reduce deforestation by demanding that as part of trade agreements. And Alencar says that 50% of Brazil's national emissions come from deforestation and land use changes, and the other 20% is agriculture. So most of Brazil's emissions don't come from fossil fuel use like transportation or industry, as in the West. And yet, Brazil is the seventh largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. Their only meaningful way to change that is to halt deforestation and to green up their agricultural operations. On September 4th, IPAM released a briefing paper on where fires are occurring. They found, by analyzing hotspots, that one-third of the fires happened on publicly owned land with no designated tenure. That means the deforestation is illegal. People are cutting the trees in order to, quote, grab this area. This is land grabbing, land speculation, says Alencar. The only way to straighten that out, she says, is with a police force. The Brazilian government has sent in troops and declared a 60-day ban on setting new fires in the Amazon, but that may not stop rampant illegal clearing and logging, and the logs can sit a little longer before the next round of big fires appear on the satellite photos. I asked about a tipping point for the Amazon. Both the Woods Hole expert and the Brazilian scientists agreed that is a real and worrying possibility. Perhaps not for the whole Amazon. Maybe the southern grasslands or savanna will march further and further north, deep into the former rainforest, the great rainforest of the world. You can find a link to the live YouTube recording of that seminar in my show blog at ecoshock.org. It's worth a watch. My thanks to the Woods Hole Research Center for hosting and getting the real facts out there about this fire emergency in the Amazon.
And what can I possibly say about the Bahamas? I am grieving. The world is grieving. This is one of the most beautiful people in one of the most beautiful places. But I think we can see now that with rising seas, the storms, perhaps as James Hansen told us about, are coming. And with that, we have to reassess what islands in the Caribbean will any longer be inhabitable. And where will those people go? We've often focused on the South Pacific Islands, but now we see with these monster storms, rising seas, storm surge, that some Caribbean islands are going to have to be evacuated. We're going to have good places for them to go and welcoming places for them to go because they did not cause the climate change. And so we'll have to do a show eventually about what happened in the Bahamas. It will take scientists a little time to assess what happened there, and then we'll speak about it. For now, it's too painful to speak.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
How did cold Alaska become the hot, smoky place? That was summer 2019 with record-shattering heat, a pocket of drought, and smoke that choked out Anchorage and Fairbanks. Is a new climate emerging in the far north? Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist and researcher at the International Arctic Research Center, University of Alaska Fairbanks. You will find Brian's quotes in Forbes or CNN. He just lived through all that wildfire smoke. Brian, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, how are you doing today, Alex?
Pretty good. So I want to ask you the classic question, how was your summer?
Well, this was the summer of warm and choking on wildfire smoke in Alaska. Well, in Anchorage in particular, Alaska was warm everywhere, but the core of that heat was centered in the southern part of the state. And, of course, the epicenter of the smoky conditions was also focused on the southern portion of the state as well.
Was it Fairbanks that actually smashed a record that they'd never seen before as far as temperature goes?
You know, it was Anchorage, where I'm located, had we had the warmest June on record. We had the warmest July on record. And then we just finished with the warmest August on record. and any number of daily records just obliterated previous high temperature marks. Particularly, we hit 90 degrees on July 4th. I believe that's 32°C. And that was several degrees warmer than any observed temperature ever, you know, in basically in 100 years of record keeping. And not only was it just a one day, we had just a remarkably warm, about a two-week period where we had, I think, 7 of our 10 warmest days on record in a two-week period. And then it kind of eased off a little bit, but then it warmed back up in August. And so we actually ended up with all-time records in August and for dailies, but also for consecutive days in a row and seasonal totals. So by every single metric, it was the warmest summer on record. And not only that, it was the driest summer on record. In fact, if you take our summer precipitation, and if you were to double it, it would still be the driest on record. And so that was a major contributor to the wildfires we saw this summer.
These are remarkable changes you're talking about. I live in British Columbia, just south of Alaska, and in the previous 2 years, summer became a threatening season. We had an evacuation kit near the door for a couple of weeks. We couldn't breathe outside. We had to stay in the house with the window shut in hot weather. Does that sound familiar?
In many ways, it does. Here in Anchorage, the smoke was thick at times, and it was persistent, and it was unhealthy air. The fire that contributed most of the smoke is about 75 to 80 kilometers to the south. And for those people that live closer to the fire, it was a much more severe hazard as far as people with respiratory conditions, safety as well. You know, they had to close the only highway that accesses that part of the state many, many times. You know, it was more than just an inconvenience. It affected many people's lives, and a number of people actually lost their homes. Businesses were burned down in some locations. So it was a very difficult situation.
What was it about this summer that made Alaska ripe for massive forest fires?
Our wildfire season is very compact compared to other locations farther south. We have about a two-month fire season. It kicks in almost reliably the 1st of June, and it typically fades away like clockwork at the end of July. And what happened this year was we had a number of days with thunderstorms early in the season, so in the first week of June, and those started many, many fires. But what really made the situation quite severe was the incredible drought that then set up and took hold of basically the entire state for the next 2 months. And so fires starting are a normal process, but the occasional rain, particularly starting in July, that reliably sets in, just didn't happen this year. And so the fires, there was nothing to slow the fires down. And then the incredible warmth that we had worked to dry out the vegetation, which made it even more flammable. And it was very sunny and light winds. And so that sun helped dry out the vegetation even more. So really everything kind of came together to make the fire season really exceptional. And then to top it all off, like clockwork, normally our rainy season kicks in the 1st of August and it puts out the fires. It didn't happen this year in the southern part of the state. Here in Anchorage, we normally average measurable rain on half of all days. Well, we just didn't get any rain at all. I mean, we had just a few millimeters like the last day of the month. And so it was it extended the fire season much, much later than is typical. So that really compounded the crisis in the fire this year.
What would create those conditions? I mean, was the jet stream different? Was there some sort of blocking pattern? I mean, this sounds like a big change for the state.
So what I like to tell people is it's a combination of factors. The first factor is we've had a long-term warming. And so, you know, that's our climate base state is warmer than it used to be. And so that's kind of like the background noise that everything sits on top of. You throw on that record warm ocean waters surrounding the state, and so now that's going to be liberating a lot of heat from that water into the nearby atmosphere. And so that kind of warms the area around us. It's like, you know, imagine in a bathroom, you fill up a bathtub full of hot water, and you let it sit for a couple hours. Well, what happens to that bath water? It gets close to room temperature, but where did that heat go? Well, that heat escaped into the air in the bathroom, so it warmed up the air. Well, it's kind of the same effect here. And then on top of that, we had a very unusual set of weather patterns. We had high pressure that just sat over the same area relentlessly the entire summer. So if you look at the upper levels of the atmosphere, we had the record, you know, highest pressures for June. And then in July, we had record highest pressures. And then in August, we had record highest pressures. So it was an unusual weather pattern, but it was the persistence that was really, really remarkable. You know, these things normally, they're transients. They come and they go, but they have it almost unmoved for months. It's really just astounding.
So in 2016, you co-authored a paper titled An Assessment of the Role of Anthropogenic Climate Change in the Alaska Fire Season of 2015. What was special about 2015?
Well, 2015 was a big fire year. You know, we had, you know, over 4 million acres burn, and that was one of our biggest fire years on record. And, you know, a lot of the questions that get proposed when we have a big fire year, and 2019 is another big fire year, it wasn't quite as big, 2015, but one of the things that we ask ourselves is, well, is this our future? Is this a condition that we're going to be experiencing more frequently as the climate warms? And so it's important to step back and they say, you know, is this what are the contributions of our long-term warming climate to these increases in the fire seasons? And what we found was that we expect that in a warming world, we expect in the boreal forests of the north, particularly in Alaska, for there to be more fires and therefore to be more acreage, square miles, square kilometers burned in that warming world. And so when we model this and we say, okay, we're going to have, in a warming world, we're going to have more fires and more fire acreage. Oh, and by the way, humans are largely responsible for the warming world. Then we can make some attributions and say, you know, we are responsible for the increase in the fire acreage to some degree. You know, how much of that degree is, we're still working on that in the models. But we can say that our contribution to warming the world is also contributing to increasing the amount of fires and fire acreage here in Alaska.
It's an interesting problem because climate models predict increased precipitation in the subarctic and the Arctic during this century, and that happens at the same time that the Arctic is warming more than the rest of the world, really. So will wetter forests decrease forest fire activity, or will the extra heat overcome that? How does that work out?
That's a great question. And so you're absolutely correct. We expect there to be more precipitation in a warming world, I mean, generally everywhere, but certainly in the Arctic, high latitude areas. And so there's this paradox. You say, well, if it's going to be wetter, well, isn't that going to mean it's going to be harder for fires to start and we would get less fire acreage? And what we found is that the increase in temperature and the increase in atmospheric moisture will lead to increases in instability that will make thunderstorms much more common. So we're going to have potentially, 50% more thunderstorm activity. And what we found is that increase in thunderstorm activity will overwhelm the increase in precipitation. And so the warming temperatures will work to cause vegetation to become more biomass, so there'll be more stuff to burn, basically. And when it doesn't rain, it'll be warmer, which will dry out the vegetation even more between the rainfall events. So what we'll see is conditions like this summer will become more common, where we may end up this year with more precipitation than normal, but in between those precipitation events, a lot of dryness, a lot of warmth, and then consequently, when we do get thunderstorms, a lot of fire activity.
Yeah, you mentioned the lightning, and I think you said that around 2013 or one of those years, there was a time when there were extreme fire conditions. Everything was ready to burn, but it wasn't a bad fire year because you just didn't get the lightning to spark it off.
Yeah, you need a certain set of ingredients for a fire. And, in Alaska, about 95%, and it varies year to year, but on balance, about 95% of the fire acreage is a result of lightning. Lightning started fires. And so if you don't have that lightning to start the fires, then you're just not going to get it, that acreage. Also, it's important to remember that fire activity is highly variable year to year. So we've had some very, very low fire years in the last decade. We've also had some very, very big ones. And so we have to be careful that when we look at a time series, we have to look at these things over long time periods. We have to look at aggregations of years. So, for example, if next year, we may not have many fires next year. And so would we say, oh, well, maybe they were wrong. Maybe we won't have more fire activity in a warming world. But you need to step back and look at all the atmospheric parameters and are they coming together for thunderstorms. And so because we have, when you deal statistically with small numbers, when I say small numbers, I mean the number of thunderstorms. So in an entire season, for example, Alaska may have as many lightning strikes as you might have in one day in a bad thunderstorm complex around Oklahoma City. I think a few days ago, they had almost 1 million lightning strikes around Oklahoma City, in a 24-hour period. Well, that's more than we had the entire year. So you can have a couple of lightning thunderstorm outbreaks that start a lot of fires in Alaska, or those may not come together in a particular year, and you might not have many fires. And that's what happened in 2013, in 2008, and a couple other years in the last decade. But on balance, those number of thunderstorms is going up, the number of lightning strikes is going up, and the number of fires and fire acreage is going up.
Well, we know the warming is happening across the Arctic and across the Northern Hemisphere, but I wonder, did the same weather system help Siberia to experience the major wildfires that it had in this same summer as Alaska did?
I'm not familiar with the amount of lightning activity they had in Siberia, but they certainly had conditions, atmospheric conditions, that once fires were started, helped promote fire growth and extreme fire behavior. And so climatologically, they have many of the same settings as we have here in Alaska and in other parts of the world, the Northern Boreal Forest. And, once you get those lightning strikes to spark it, there's really no stopping it once you have the warm conditions and the dryness. You need the rainfall to come and stop it. And during the time of our high sun season, so June and particularly the first part of July, we saw the same thing here as they saw in Siberia, and that was, once these fires get going, they are relentless in the acreage that they burn, and that the dry conditions that we saw here were also evident in particularly in western Siberia. You can't put the fires out.
Well, I know in northern Canada, like in the Yukon and further east from that, we don't even try to put the fires out. It's impossible to get the human power in to do it. So when they start, they burn.
That's the same thing here in Alaska, and presumably it's the same in Siberia. You know, we're talking about remote areas that are very difficult to get into. There's no highways. There's no infrastructure to get people in there. And the what small populations are there are generally along rivers and can be evacuated if necessary. But there's just not the infrastructure to fight fires, and there's not the need in many cases because it's just wide open forest for the most part. So the management strategy in Alaska is primarily to let the fires burn unless they are threatening people or structures, or we have native allotments. So, you know, once the fires go, they basically just burn. And you see that if you look at the statistics on the number of fires, and I mentioned lightning accounts for the overwhelming vast majority of acreage burned. Well, if you actually look at the raw number of fires, it's about even with human starts and lightning starts. But the human start fires are generally, you know, they're in the cities, or they're right along what highways we do have, and so they contribute very little to the overall acreage because they're able to be put out usually in very quick time. So, you know, fires are good for the ecology of a region, and so there are benefits to the fires. But as the acreage increases over time, we have other considerations that we didn't even used to think of, and that is how it affects the total carbon budget for the Earth. You know, fires contribute, depending on which study you look at, approximately 5 to 10% of the global carbon emissions. If we increase the fire activity globally, then that contribution is going to increase.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and we're talking with Brian Brettschneider from the International Arctic Research Center. I'm glad you brought up the amount of carbon released, because climate critics used to say carbon from wildfires doesn't count because the trees will regrow and recapture the same amount of CO2. But I wonder if the scale of new wildfires, not just in the north, but we've got South America and Africa, whether that will speed up global warming. What do you think, Brian?
Well, you're correct in noting that, you know, if we assume that the size of forests or the coverage of forests globally remains constant, that the contribution of carbon to the atmosphere, you know, is functionally a constant. You know, so if 20% of the Earth, and I don't know this number, I'm using it as an example. Mm-hmm. 20% of the Earth is forested, and it, you know, it burns at a regular rate historically, then you could kind of assume that that's not a changing part of the system. But that coverage of forest doesn't stay constant over time. And so as we are burning more forest, particularly as we're changing the forest cover into something else, into pasture land or other agricultural purposes or urban purposes, as we're decreasing the total amount of forest cover globally, then that has an impact, because once we burn a forest now and that forest doesn't come back, now we've removed that future sequestration of carbon from the atmosphere. Also, as we burn a lot right now, you know, it contributes locally to the global warming that's occurring as we speak. And so even if you say, well, it's going to, you know, in 100 years, you know, that tree, that forest will grow back and it'll sequester that carbon, that may be true, but now what's going to happen between now and the next 100 years? You know, we're in this positive feedback cycle where we have something close to runaway global warming. Hopefully we're not there yet. But we don't have the luxury of saying, well, it'll be okay in 100 years because these trees will grow back. We need to worry about, you know, what's going to happen between now and those next 100 years.
Some scientists are concerned that the Amazon may burn enough that it will switch over towards being a savanna or a grasslands instead of a tropical forest. Are there any expectations that if we have more and more serious fires in the boreal forest, that it will, say, become open peat bog or something different than what it was?
You know, that's a good question. And there's not a lot of concern about the boreal forest transforming ecologically into another kind of ecoregion. But that said, you know, as, say, our black spruce forests, as they warm up and as the permafrost melts and they dry out, it's going to be more suitable for white spruce to move in. Areas that are kind of white spruce forests, as they warm up, they're going to be more suited to deciduous forest. And as the Arctic areas warm up, that are currently just tundra, they're going to actually have more trees move in there where there's currently no trees. And so there are going to be some land cover changes. But I think the biggest concern here in the high latitudes is what's going to happen with the permafrost and the tundra. You know, as we melt permafrost, that adds tremendous amounts of carbon to the atmosphere, carbon that's been locked in the soil locally for decades, centuries perhaps, you know, can all be released in a relatively short amount of time. And then also the tundra fires. And we haven't had tundra fires here in Alaska in 2019. We have in other years, but Siberia's had some tundra fires this year, and those are particularly bad when it comes to releasing carbon in the atmosphere. Because again, the tundra isn't able to fully decompose. The vegetation can't decompose fully during the short summer. And so freeze-up occurs and it gets locked in there, and the next year new grasses grow, and they don't have time to fully decompose, and it just accumulates over long periods of time. And when that burns, it releases many, many years of stored carbon all at once. So that's a concern that we have moving forward, is that we're going to have more of these fires in the tundra as thunderstorms become more common up there.
Tell us about your trip to the Spencer Glacier and what that tells us about climate change.
Well, I had the privilege of traveling to some glaciers around Anchorage in the recent this summer, you know, to demonstrate and to kind of get a handle on what kind of melting is occurring at the glaciers here locally and how that is going to affect the sea level rise and what it means for the ecology of the region and how it's emblematic of what's transforming in the north right now. And in this part of Alaska and adjacent British Columbia, we have many, many glaciers, and it's a result of tremendous precipitation that falls, you know, several thousand feet up, 1,000 or so meters in elevation, in marginal temperature environments. So we have very, very large precipitation values that fall just below freezing. And so we end up with these very impressive glaciers, but they are always right on the edge of kind of catastrophe, because when you warm temperatures up just a little bit, you all of a sudden change a lot of that snow into rain. And that has a dual effect of, one, it's not accumulating new snow higher up to feed the glaciers, but also that rain actually, you know, melts snow and ice that's either on the glacier or part of the glacier. And so it really facilitates tremendous melting of the glaciers. And that's what we're seeing here in this part of the state, is our glaciers are in very rapid retreat. They're thinning at all elevations of the glacier, so from the top all the way to the bottom. And our trips over to some of these glaciers this summer just really show dramatic changes over small time periods. You know, you come back year after year, and the glaciers look visibly different, even without taking any formal measurements. It's really dramatic, and it helps to show people what these changes look like over short time periods, because, you know, we can sometimes kind of get lost in thinking of these things in longer timescales. You know, we worry about, oh, well, what will Greenland look like in 100 or 500 years? Or, you know, what will sea level be like in 100 years? But you can see these changes occurring on an annual basis. It really drives home, you know, the sense of urgency about, you know, what needs to be done to turn the ship around.
Is the ice around Alaska getting darkened by smoke from the wildfires, therefore changing its ability to absorb heat?
You know, whenever there is a wildfire, you know, that soot, that black carbon gets released into the atmosphere. The glaciers in Alaska are typically far in the southern part of the state where there's normally fewer forest fires. And so that's not as much of a concern in Alaska as it is in, say, Greenland, where there collecting soot from not only from forest fires, but also from industrial activities, most notably from Asia. But, you know, we have volcanoes in this part of the state, and the volcanoes tend to, the ash, not only from active eruptions, but the ash from historic eruptions that gets blown around on dry, windy days, that's probably more of a factor than the soot from the forest fires on balance.
I know people in the Canadian North who think global warming would be a good idea, at least for them. Maybe winters wouldn't be so harsh and summers a little closer to tropical. What do you think, Brian? Will warming up be good for people living in Alaska?
You know, I actually hear that argument from time to time. You know, there used to be, you'd see bumper stickers on cars and it would say, you know, Alaskans for global warming. And if you look at all the, you know, the positives and the negatives of a warming world, the negatives far outweigh the positives. But on the positive side of the ledger, you know, people would be more comfortable and people would have less expensive heating bills. But on balance, you know, everything else is bad. You know, everything, you know, I tell people, you know, everything that I love about Alaska and everything that defines the characteristic of this place and all places, because the climate defines, you know, the look and the feel of a place. And everything is built for the climate. The way we build houses and all infrastructure is a function of what the climate of an area is like. And as the climate changes, this place will become different. It'll become more like, you know, Washington State or Idaho, which are great places, but they're not Alaska. And those places will become different. They'll become, you know, more like Nevada or Utah. And so as the climate warms, our sense of place becomes affected because the nature of locations will just be different. That said, you know, humans can adapt. We can adapt. We can build new homes and we can change our infrastructure. But the environment around us may not be able to adapt fast enough. You know, tree species may not be able to adapt to the climate, and the plants and the animals may not be able to adapt. And so while we may be more comfortable, the environment around us may have a kind of a catastrophic downward spiral along the way.
Well, if it burns down and the trees fall over because the permafrost is melting and the fish that so many in Alaska depend on going out to fish, if they disappear, it doesn't sound really very good in the long run to have global warming, even there.
No. And so while you may have a more pleasant summer to outdoor recreate in, the activities that people like to do for their recreation, like fishing or, you know, kayaking, you know, those kind of things, those activities may not be left for us to do if the fish don't return or if the characteristics of our rivers and our forests change. You know, everything about the place would be different and it wouldn't be nearly as enjoyable.
Is there anything else you'd like to add as we wrap up here, Brian?
You know, one of the things that people like to ask me, they say, is this the new normal? Is this our future? And it's a complicated question, and it can be unsatisfying when we talk about probabilities. But, you know, this kind of summer is unprecedented. And we may say, well, this was a one in a, the odds of this happening in any given year might be 1 in 100 or 1 in 500. And in the future, you know, we may not have a summer this warm again for another 20 or 30 or 50 years. But the likelihood is much greater now, whereas it was basically impossible to have a summer this warm before, you know, the last few decades. And now it is possible. Not only that, it's going to be more likely moving forward. So we need to look at these things in relevant timescales because, again, next summer may be much cooler, but the likelihood, the probability of these kind of extreme summers is much greater moving forward than it's ever been.
From the University of Alaska Fairbanks, we've been speaking with Dr. Brian Brettschneider, and you can find links to his work, and you can find his popular Twitter feed. It's @climatologist49. And I'll put more links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Brian, I hope you will breathe easier for the rest of the year.
Yes, you know, we finally got a little bit of wind and a little bit of rain in the last few days. Not very much, but it's at least blown the smoke out to sea. So we are breathing easier for the time being.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening to Radio EcoShock. Check out my blog at ecoshock.org and please tune in again next week.